So my plan for this event was that Graham and Maria would do all the talking, but yeah, they suggested that I say something as by way of introduction, which kind of seemed fair. So I was just going to say a little bit about why I wanted to show here, and just about a bit about the work that's here. About 5 years ago, I started making drawings for children, and usually the images were children with their eyes closed. And I showed that work because I wanted to show the work somewhere where children would see it. I showed it at the Museum of Childhood in Bethnal Green. And at that time I had this idea that I suppose when you've been making artwork for a long time, the question is, who is it for? And if you've been banging around the artwork for a while, you get a little bit disenchanted with that question. You want to make work that really has an audience, a really immediate audience. And I suppose when I started making work that was portraiture, which is quite accessible, I wanted it to be seen by the people I was drawing and by their families. And so, going on from that, I wanted to ask different people's opinion on the work. So maybe the parents of the children. And then I was put in touch with Graham, who worked with children daily. So I was asking teachers, I was asking parents, people in Graham's profession. And he came to see the show at Museum of Childhood, and he wrote an essay about it, which is in the book that we're launching tonight. And what I liked about it was he wrote it in a way that gave me access in. I could see how other people could view the work. And that, obviously, as an artist, that's very interesting to be able to step into your audience's thoughts. And I suppose we all have a sense about children. We've all been children, even if we're not, we don't live with them. So there's something about that kind of accessibility that I wanted to access in the work that I was making. So when I came here to the Freud, and I was obviously, as probably everybody here, is absolutely taken with the kind of atmosphere of the place, with this sort of feeling that it's still inhabited, and thinking about Anna Freud living and working in the room next door. My plan was I wanted to make work to put into that room. And one thing about the children with their eyes closed was this sense of them having some kind of interior life. So some way of refusing the gaze, the adult gaze, the gaze that controls them. And I called the series Dream, because I felt that there was some way in which we were looking at children that had this huge imaginative experience that was inaccessible. I was particularly taken with a quote by Simone de Beauvoir, when she and the last show was called Absurd Impositions. She talks about the absurd impositions that adults put onto children that have no meaning for the children, because they don't understand the rules or the regulations that they're working by. When I started to read about Anne Freud's writing, I realised that she seemed to me to have this amazing understanding of what it is to be a child, what it is to have that experience, and to be perhaps in a world that puts demands that make no sense. So the work in there is from the Dream series. So I'm working in pencil and in silver point, and I've also done some work from the fantastic photographic archive that you can see online at the Freud Museum. So I took some drawings. There's a drawing that I worked from Martin Freud, and there's a drawing of Anna Freud. So, and then the rest of the work is in here. There's two series. The series of large pieces of young women there's a companion pieces, one with their eyes open and then one with their eyes closed. which again was very much thinking about this notion of the gaze of the child with their eyes closed could be retreating from the world or from the adult in position. The child with their eyes open, there's some kind of I called the first series of these imperative, because there's some kind of demand being made of the viewer. I was quite interested in. I was also particularly interested in working with images of young girls. Because there was something in it about how they form their identity. These were girls sort of 11, 12 years old. So it's a kind of pre-adolescent moment in childhood that I wanted to explore. And I paired those with some extracts from Henry James' story, Turn of the Screw. And I won't go into it all now, because it's a bit complicated, but has anyone read Turn of the Screw?
Yes.
Okay, great. There's the governess in Turn of the Screw. The story hinges on, you know, does she see ghosts? Because it is a terrific ghost story if you read it on one level. Or is she becoming unhinged herself? And this is her neurosis being played out. A lot of the writing about Turn of the Screw is, you know, Freudian analysis of this. But there's also evidence that I've written about in the book about whether the story is actually based on a Freud case study, the case of Miss Lucy R. But again, the governess's story, as she tells it, she's kind of, you get the feeling that she's sort of, as she's making her story, she's making herself. So she tells her story to work out who she is. So there's this double kind of consciousness of her telling her story, but her also seeing herself telling her story. Which again, I thought had an interesting relationship to female identity. So that's why these two works are opposite each other in the exhibition. So that's a kind of whistle-stop tour of some of the things that I was thinking about when I was making the work. But I think I'm going to hand over to Maria, who's going to talk a bit about this idea of looking at someone and the notion of whether you can look with impunity or whether there needs to be reciprocity or what the power relationships in that kind of looking are.
Thank you. I'm not sure I'm going to use all of that exactly, but I'm certainly going to wind up there. So I thought what I sort of talk about, to sort of work my way into it really, is my encounter with the work. And any encounter with an artist's work is never a neutral space. So when Rebecca invited me to, if I was interested in writing an essay for the catalogue, I went down to her studio to see. I hadn't seen these images before, the Dream series and then this new work. So I went down to have a look at it, and it immediately resonated because of my art historical and theoretical interests. So I'm just going to say a little bit about two aspects of those that really resonated and how. And then I went on to construct an essay around this idea of an other kind of look or another kind of gaze. That my essay in the catalogue is called Towards a Maternalized Optics. And what I was interested in was how, obviously, we're looking at something, they're visual pieces, but I was interested in the idea of a gaze that surpasses the visual register, and this resonated with two issues that I just want to briefly introduce now. So to help me focus, I've just got a couple of images. Let's have the first one. The first thing that I just wanted to say is that, I mean, there's a lot of difficulty around images of children, and particularly work by women artists making work about their children, or about, I mean, these are other people's children as well as your children. But there's a, you know, there's a whole history of this. So I'm only going to talk for about 10 minutes, so I'm going to just sort of like briefly just say something about... It's often encapsulated with work like Mary Kelly. This is just one small... I'm not going to say too much about it because it's just to as a launching pad really into this debate. But this is one part of a multi-piece installation. There's 176 pieces. They're very small. And they document the first 6 years of Mary Kelly's, the artist, British artist, of her life with her son. And but the point I want to make is that she is the epitomizes one strand of this debate about what we call in psychoanalytic theory maternal fetishism. And it was this idea in the 70s and in the 80s actually that I had this notion that, well, the female subject had been kind of, if you like, written out in psychoanalytic theory. So this was about kind of reclaiming a space for a female subject, a mother, in terms of a fetish object, and the child and the signifiers that make up the components of the child's development through those first 6 years become represented in this installation. Now, the point I want to make is that in Kelly's work, there's an avoidance of what we might generally refer to as a kind of overt visual pleasure of the image. So her work is very much refracted through conceptualism and Lacanian psychoanalytic theory. So there was a kind of almost like an implicit censorship, really, of women making images of children, because they're considered to be sentimental, perhaps, or slightly perverse in some way. And in fact, the critic Emily Apter in the 1990s, I just wanted to say that quote something from her. She said that she was at this conference and she ended up showing images of her children, and she knew that she was doing the wrong thing in this context, because it wasn't the thing that was allowed, because maternal desire, she said, remains virtually unouted in both public sphere of institutions and the critical sphere of theoretical production. Now, Emily Apter, like myself really, would take the view that that this is a problematic thing, and you know, she celebrates Mary Kelly's work, as do I in my book, Art and Psychoanalysis. However, okay, so that's one thing. If I have the next image, the other side of that sort of debate then swings to the other side, and we have an extreme seduction of the kind of visual register, that optical register. And Sally Mann in the, this was a series, The Immediate Family, done over a number of years, a series of photographs of her children. And she got a lot of press, to say the least. There was, you know, a big controversy, you know, Sally Mann, you know, she's a perverse, what kind of a mother is she? But aside from moving slightly towards the position of the child then as well, there are problems with, you know, imaging children, because... nice quote from Jacqueline Rose here, that we need to see children as innocent, because if they're not presented as innocent, somehow that's a challenge to our own adult sexuality, and this is something that we want to hold off. So this is her work was really created, well, it got a lot of publicity. I mean, in some ways, there's no such thing as bad publicity in the sense that it promoted her work, but it was controversial. And I've just got one more image from that series, because it's got a kind of a very different but uncanny, I think, resemblance to perhaps one of the first her of you. Just that sort of you know, abundance of
potential.
Hair. Hair, which I see as a kind of a... I didn't want to say hair, because... because it relates to what I'm going to go on to, my sort of, you know, where I'm going with this. In the sense that trying to... Obviously, it's hair on a kind of a visual level, but there's a kind of, you know, I'm trying to get towards it, maybe an affective level where one kind of loses that kind of sense of identity, and there's something much more ambiguous, but also a more of a series of identifications with a number of kind of things that just resonate in the world, hair being one of them. Okay, so yes, so these would be opposite camps, really. There's on the one hand this critical approach using critical theory, and on the other hand this kind of overt seduction of the visual register. Now the point is that what you couldn't do is to, in terms of art theory, because you couldn't say, oh, this is really you know, this is this kind of maternal desire, couldn't be allowed, because it was seen as kind of some kind of essentialism, that there was some kind of innate and perverse kind of essentialism. So basically, in my essay, I've actually deliberately flirted with essentialism, because post 1990s, there's been much more of a shift in how art theory relates to psychoanalytic theory, and the kind of psychoanalysts that were popular in the 90s, like Lacan, in the 80s and 90s, like Jacques Lacan, have become, and they're still popular, but in different ways. And there's been kind of more of a shift towards more affective theories in psychoanalysis, like, Melanie Klein a bit, but people like Christopher Bolas, Adam Phillips' work on Winnicott, and these kinds of ideas resonate with art historical or art theoretical ideas about how do we about thinking about a much more kind of kinesthetic relation to the image. So when I saw Rebecca's work, I wanted to if you like flirt with essentialism. And to say that, yes, there was a kind of a maternal desire, not Rebecca's desire, but a maternal desire, which isn't to do with the mother per se, but everyone can share this space. And it's a space of kind of correspondences that resonate on a much more bodily level. And in something that I've used catalogue essay comes from, I'm just going to quote Christopher Bolas. He says that rather than, the idea that maternal desire and this idea of some kind of perversity and then in the art image as kind of mirror reflection, sort of narcissistic image, these are all very defensive kinds of structures. They're very much about subject-object separation. And there's been much more of an interest, and this is what struck me about Rebecca's work, was that I didn't feel that there was this subject-object defensive relation, but much more a kind of space of what we might call mutual mirroring. Now, Christopher Bolas, psychoanalyst, he talks about a different kind of narcissistic object relation and the space of maternal desire as a kind of a transformative space. And he says that the mother of early infancy is less significant and identifiable as an object than as a process, and that's really key for me, that is identified with what he calls cumulative internal and external transformations. So I could have the next, think there are three in a series. Yeah, so I was also, obviously I'm coming to it with, I've done a lot of writing on this particular film, so I just wanted to show three images from this, three stills from this film. Yeah, I think I'll just have the three of them, and then just...
I don't know how to make
it
back.
Then leave it, I think, I'll just leave it there actually, because that's a good place to introduce this idea of a gaze, another kind of gaze. Now, in this film, I hope I'm not going on too long. I'll just say maybe say a little bit about the film and then just move specifically to the images on them that should probably reach my point then. But in this film, there's a girl and she's looking at a young man through a window, which was the first image you see her from the window. And the thing is that as the young man is lassoing, it's called lasso. But what I'm just interested here is thinking about this image, really. And this is the image before the screen in the film. Oh, yeah, but the camera's moving between the two spaces, between this kind of looking in the register of visual pleasure, seduction, that I was talking about in relation to Sally Mann. And then it keeps moving between the young man's face. He's in the living room and the girl... young woman who's outside. So moving between these two spaces, and then finally we move, it's like her face becomes more and more, if you like, disintegrated, and finally the screen moves away and focuses on a piece of snow, and then the white pixelated video screen. There's also a soundtrack, and the white pixelated image continues while the soundtrack continues, so that's also an image. What I'm saying is that there's a kind of a shift away from this kind of overt visual register. And one is responding to the image at a much more affective bodily level, much more as a kind of a process of moving in a much more ambiguous space than fixing the object of one's desire in a kind of narcissistic register. So these were things that I was already concerned with. So encountering... something of those elements in Rebecca's work, then in particular in relation to drawing and this drawing on the surface and her whole process, which some of you may know, but the images are drawn from photographs. The photographs are taken on a mobile phone. So there's this kind of move away from... the technological image to this very kind of processual space of drawing and a kind of vertical hatching, really. That's very repetitive, meditative, and this responding to the kind of surface formally, I felt this was already a kind of an ambiguous space, and then the wash of colour also exaggerates this kind of dreamlike space. And I also felt with the dream series that this inner, you know, this idea of an inner gaze, that this is a gaze that we all carry with us, and it has the potential to be a really transformative thing. And it's like kind of, I think it's bound up a lot with sort of memory traces of very early affective experiences that we wouldn't have been conscious of at the time that we'd have been picking up these almost like that's why I didn't want to go with hair, pre-linguistic, really, elements of signification, sound, touch, light, shape. And then I added the final thing then, I suppose, is that all seemed to all correspond very nicely with a reference that Rebecca had in a piece of writing that she did using Jacques Derrida, the French philosopher, using his text, Memoirs of the Blind, where it's a very beautiful text in some ways. It's an exhibition he curated of drawing. But what was really compelling was that the tension in his text between wanting not being able, in a way, I think, to go into this much more immersive space that I felt Rebecca was, her images were taking me to. And how, even though he kept in his text moving towards it, his affiliation with the much more castrating eye of the kind of fraud of a traditional psychoanalytic model prevents Derrida from seeing drawing as a transformative process. For him, it's bound up with loss and risk. And he doesn't really think women can do it because it's too risky. I thought that was really... So I also wanted to use, in a way, your work to kind of critique that and to offer a kind of a female perspective on another kind of looking. So I think I've said... 5-10 minutes
more. Okay, well, so I'm going to be doing something a little bit different. From this, because I feel slightly like a naive person in relation to art and in relation to this work. And I, when Rebecca asked me, I was very thrilled, and I thought, blimey, I don't know if I could do this. Because I'm a clinician, really, and very interested in child development and how, and I work also with very traumatised, troubled children. And also, it's very interesting because it's so much about, they're all girls, and although you talk about female gaze and female desire being untheorized by Freud particularly and psychoanalysis, there's something very, very dangerous about the male gaze, I think, around these things. So I, when I went to see these pictures in the Museum of Childhood in Bretton Green, the pictures that you see in there, and incidentally, I think they look fantastic in Anna Freud's room, but I think they look very, very different, didn't they, in Bethnal Green and a great big hall as well. I was struck by what they evoked in me, and I looked at those first, and I felt this kind of tingling of pleasure in response to these girls. And I was, and as Rebecca said, she was partly thinking about this work, this Simone de Beauvoir quote and piece called "Absurd Impositions," and the idea of the gaze being somehow intrusive and somehow taking away one's ability to reflect, that space for reverie. And that possibly the idea of eyes closed would evoke this idea of somebody in this internal state of what the psychoanalyst Beyond calls reverie. And I found that what I was experiencing was being pulled in by these girls with their eyes closed, as if... It's very interesting. I work with a lot of very damaged, traumatised children, often who've been taken away from their families and had terrible separations. And when they're getting better, they begin to play peekaboo. And I had this sense that I was being drawn in by these girls, even though their eyes were closed. And I was thinking, well, this is so interesting, because there's something about the gaze, and there's something about being seen seeing, which is so subtle, and it's so easy to either feel intruded upon or to feel left on one's own. So what I'm going to do in relation to this is show a few clips, video clips, of babies and thinking about the whole question of gaze. So this is just typical of the research that they do these days with infants and stressing just how important eyes are, interestingly.
3 months of life. 10-day-old Dylan is shown a card with two images on it. The right side has three blobs representing the rudimentary configuration of the human face. The left has the blobs inverted.
Good. Okay. Very good.
Dylan is drawn to the image that resembles the human face.
Oh,
Back at the lab, 6-week-old Devin is shown.
How about these guys now?
He turns to the image that looks more like a face. The other image no longer interests him.
Now, there's lots and lots and lots of this kind of research. Infants can't help from first moments of life, but even though they can't see very much and their vision is quite blurred, they can't help but look at faces. And research suggests that it's because they're interested in faces. Of course, it's not. They are interested in faces, but they're also interested in what they get back from faces, which I think the research doesn't quite pinpoint. And that, in a sense, we need this vision of ourselves as reflected back to us in order to feel safe enough to be in this more private space. So the great paediatrician and psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott talks about this idea of one's sense of oneself, one's first sense of oneself as being that sense of oneself as reflected back through the mother's gaze. And he also talks about the danger of impingement, which I think is what Simone de Beauvoir was talking about. And what I felt was that there is this terrible danger. Many children I work with have this terrible... They don't have any sense of reverie. In fact, they can really play symbolically and creatively. And they haven't been given this space. They haven't been given this space because they've often been impinged upon by violence and abuse, etc. But also, they've also been left on their own too much. And so they haven't been given the good gaze, which I think Marie was partly thinking about. And it's a quite subtle, complicated process getting it right. So I'm going to show you a picture. I thought I'd better put some men in here. So here's... Oh, dear. I'm going to have to get it back up now. Again. Here you can see a man, I'm not sure if it's the father or not, and the baby, trying to find a moment where they feel attuned and at ease with each other, and they're missing a lot of the time, which is a lot of what happens in relationships, I think. You might want to think who's in charge of this interaction as well.
You ready yet? Ready yet? You ready yet? You ready now? Yeah. What about way back here? What about if I saw way back here? What about way back here? Did I do it? What happened then? Okay.
It's one of the great things, one of the important things about relationships is all the time we're trying to work out. Well, there's always this process of rupture and repair, mismatch and repair. We're always getting things a bit wrong and trying to put them right again. And you have to have the confidence you can make relationships go right again, like this baby will have from this kind of interaction, in order to feel safe enough to be still and be on your own, and then to be in a creative space, I think. And so I know that so many of the kids I work with, again, they don't have this. They're either completely always vigilant, or they're off, cut off in a world of their own. And I thought these kids... You absolutely knew. Their eyes were closed, but they had such profoundly powerful... I've just shoved a couple of these images up here. But they have such lively personalities. You can't help. I couldn't help but be drawn into their worlds. It's like they were enticing us in. You might not agree. Anyway, these are purely my associations. Now, so I'm going to show you a couple of not-so-nice ones now, I'm afraid. Because just imagine what it's like, what life is like, when you do not have this good maternal gaze that can become a transformational object, as Christopher Bolas talks about. So this is a clip from the work of Amanda Jones, and here you see a baby turning away from their mother. Because remember what I said about Winnicott's gaze, that the first sense of oneself is the sense of oneself is reflected back through the mother's eyes. Here is a really quite scary sense of oneself as reflected back.
Zoe feels so negative about Izzy that she keeps her at arm's length. In turn, Izzy avoids her mother's face. Like all babies, she gets upset by stressed or blank faces and copes by turning away.
I looked at her and I just thought... I just felt numb, like nothing, no... Like she wasn't part of me, you know, but like I was never pregnant and she was nothing to do with me, in a sense. And like everybody was saying, God, isn't she beautiful? And I was looking at her thinking, well, I don't think that at all. I think she looks horrible, you know. She doesn't look like a baby to me.
I mean, when you look at her, what do you see?
Just that she doesn't feel like she's part of me. And that's what's going to make me cry. But that's... And then I feel guilty for feeling like that, because I know she's my little baby.
What the mother eventually says, and it's quite painful, is she says she thinks she sees a monster. And so this is the reflection of herself, this baby. This is the sense of herself that's reflected back through the mother's eyes. And so many of the kids I work with, again, because they've had this kind of sense of themselves, they end up in this very vigilant space and unable to find an interior space that Rebecca talks about, so that describes so beautifully in her work, I think. So I'm going to show you a couple of quick other clips of the opposite, in a way, of a mother who's not able to interact with her babies and is very withdrawn, and the baby then retreats into their own world, which again gives rise to being in a world of your own, which is a very, very lonely, desperate, and rather, well, this very neglected, thin place, with a very thin in terms of the richness of the internal world. So have a few seconds.
And I didn't know at this point in time that Jaden had actually been exposed to witnessing quite a lot of violence between his parents. The whites of his eyes show quite markedly as well, and you can see here that he had a slightly frightened response. He pulls away from his mum's hand.
He was frightened, but also he was very, very cut off and very, very deadened. And so I partly use this image because I was thinking, well, it's fine giving a child an interior space and not impinging, but the children desperately want something back as well. This is maybe too hard. I'm going to show you about 3 seconds of this. This is from the work of Brenda Spitz in the 1940s, but this is a baby in an orphanage. So it's just too horrible to see one few moments. Just imagining. And it's so clear that the kids that Rebecca has drawn have not had either of those kinds of experiences. And I know that they're kids that you know, and they're parents. And so when I went to see these, when I first went to see the exhibition, I was struck by these images in pairs that Rebecca drew. And they drew me in with their eyes closed. And then there were these very powerful images in another series, which I didn't realise isn't here, which is called, I forgot what it's called.
Imperative.
And these are feisty young women who are strong and tough, and they were just coming into puberty, really. They're not young women. But I thought these were strong, strong in many ways, sort of post-feminist, very impressive, young women by the looks that they gave. I was struck after seeing these very delicate pictures of girls with their eyes closed, which for me filled me with a sense of awe, but also a sense of tremendous responsibility as an adult. Then I saw these very striking images coming back at me, and I realised I had a bit of a jolt. I thought, well, actually, even though they've got their eyes open, I haven't got a clue what's going on inside them. They're not drawing me in a way, they're pushing me away in a very different sort of way to the first set of images. You may or may not agree, because these are purely my associations. So, I'll show you another man there. This is a granddad. So I think that what we're trying to do when we're trying to develop these transformational spaces in our interior world, but also for adults, for children, and... is that we have to have that balance between being in somebody's presence and in our own space. And that balance has to feel comfortable, because when it doesn't, then we're in trouble. So there's a lovely moment here. You see a grandfather and a child interacting.
Lifts his left arm and actually reaches out and touches grandfather's mouth, where the game is being played. Grandfather now opens his mouth wider. And with great energy, Jordan follows suit. They take much delight in this joyful engagement. Jordan throws his head back and opens his mouth even a bit wider. A moment of pause, but they're still engaged. Now Grandfather switches to puckering his lips. The baby looks at Grandfather's face. Jordan focuses on the mouth and imitates the puckering. After Jordan turns away to rest, Grandfather paces himself to the baby, which is so important. All infants need...
And I think that's really, really crucial. I think in a way that partly captures what Rebecca was talking about. What we know about infants, for example, is that their heart rate goes up about 6 seconds before they turn their head away. In other words, their body is telling them, I need a space from this gaze. And if an adult can respond to that, and that's something we all need as well, then we begin to learn what we need in order to retreat. We can communicate our needs. And then we are able to come back when we're ready, if the other person is there for us. And so often, with children, the gaze is either over-intrusive, because we can't bear them to move away, or we just leave them be. So, and I thought this was a lovely example, again, of that balance, which gives rise to, I think, this capacity, as these experiences are built up, second by second, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, week by week, over the first few years of life, gives rise to this extraordinary capacity for what, for, I very much like Christopher Kitbullis's ideas about transformational objects, and he's also using Winnicott's ideas of the true self, this idea that when you have this space, then you can use objects to become creative. But you can only do that if you've got inside yourself this sense of safety, but also you've built up these interior aspects of yourself and other people. So I'm going to show you, my final clip is a lovely clip of a little girl playing. And what you see here is a girl who you know has been given so much from the good gaze of the other, in order to develop the capacity for this creativity and this symbolic play that Winnicott felt was, starting with a transitional object, was the root of all imagination and indeed of all culture.
Rules which seem to govern. Acting out family life with her toys helps her make sense of the adult world of punishment and reward.
This was naughty. Sit here on your tray. Oh, I'm nice. Please, naughty. This was good. This was naughty.
And like her new baby brother,
he's
one toy is singled out for special treatment.
Then let someone soften in my nipple. Let's see, he wants to.
There's something so delicious, but so, and so awe-inspiring, but so delicate about this kind of creative play. I'm sure other people have had the experience of hearing children play behind a bedroom door and knowing, desperate to go in and see, but knowing if you go in, that it will just completely destroy the moment. And I had a similar feeling when I saw Rebecca's the pair drawings that are in the next door, that there's this huge sense of responsibility because of the vulnerability and the subtlety of what's developing. So, and I thought the works just captured that absolutely beautifully. And I also think the works captured the other works that I saw, and these ones as well, captured these other gazes. So I think I've probably said enough now. We need to have a discussion. But anyway, that's my lot.
So, it's really interesting because there's lots of stuff in there, but. So as I was making the work, so one of the questions was about the face as a portal to some kind of interior, and whether that was kind of viable or not. And obviously there's a history of, in the last century you could tell, they thought you could tell a criminal by looking at their face, by measuring the circumference of their skulls or whatever. But there is a sense in which I think people are continually making judgments, as you say, by looking at others. And I think one of the reasons I first looked at Turn of the Screw was because that the children in Turn of the Screw are described as these absolutely pure, beautiful children, and yet the implication is that they somehow become evil. They, you know, somewhere in them is lurking this potential to wreak havoc. So I was really interested in this notion, and I think it's very heightened with children, but I think it's there in all kind of human action, interactions. This kind of this space, this it's a kind of doorway into this kind of internal life.
It's really interesting question, because there are these cliches about the eyes being windows of the soul, but it's also true that we are the only primate that have this. I think it's called sclera, this white around the iris. And we're designed, in a way, we've evolved to really try to read other people's faces all the time, and also to read how we're being perceived all the time. So...
And which is why I always find it a relief to get away from from that, in a way. I mean, in the sense that I know what you're saying about, you know, when you were saying about how... it was interesting what you were saying about the baby, that the baby needs to look away at times because it's too much. Mm. It's like if you're with, you know, someone, say two people who are in love, if they're staring at each other's eyes, you know, after a while that can get really claustrophobic as well, which is another, you know, that's another relation that's built on the kind of baby parental kind of thing. So that the baby needs to look away, but there needs to be this balance. But so I think... That's the case. I think that is the case. But in like looking at visual culture, say, like in particularly horror films, and I mean, that sounds like I haven't read it, but that you know, I can see these images of children from things like, I don't know, all of these like horror movies, The Others, even Damien, you know, these angelic children who don't return, who use that to create a kind of an unreadable text, if you like, and they're very intriguing. And in a kind of visual culture, I think it's intriguing to, and I think for me it's pleasurable to be presented with a kind of blankness, which in everyday life would just be either annoying or traumatic. You know, it could be, because like, I mean, in child development, you know, it's something that, you know, you don't want the child to remain in this kind of blankness. But in the space of the work of art, I kind of enjoy a sort of blankness where there's obviously there's eyes, but I think you're right about, you know, I mean, what you were saying, your impressions about how you know, when you were looking at the ones with the girls with their eyes open. That the surface of the image is not allowing you beyond that surface because of how, and I think that goes beyond, like, that really is to do with then, you know, the materiality of the work for me.
Yeah.
That you're very much concerned with a kind of a surface. There is this tension, I don't know, maybe it's a tension between, on the one hand, we do read, you know, we do look to eyes all the time. I mean, that's, and we have our own surveying, you know, eyes as well, trying to figure out how we're placed in the field of the gaze, so to speak. But then there's a kind of a refusal, very subtle and refusal.
I suppose for me, I think the thing is that this beyond, you know, this kind of like you're looking through the face to the person. It perhaps presupposes there's a kind of fixed identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with, as I was saying, you know, with children of a certain age, it's very obvious that identity is not yet fixed. But probably for all people there is a sense that, you know, this kind of, you know, the changeability of who we are. And so I think there's that sense that, you know, that of that kind of pushing it, that back on the viewer, because you know, what is it you're going to get? Because, you know, these encounters, they're fleeting. You know, you're many different people too many different people, and you know, different facets of your personality come out. So I think there was that sense in which there was a presupposition with a portrait that you're going to make it like the person, and that's one of the reasons there's two portraits, is because, you know, how can you do that? I know, you know, I was brought up to look at portrait artists who made paintings over years and years and years to try and get to the essence of the person. And I'm really fascinated with that process, just because it's about looking at someone all day long for, you know, like a year or 2 years or whatever, which I think is a very interesting procedure to go through. But whether you end up with something that is that person, I don't know. So actually with all the drawings, you know, I had lots and lots of drawings. In the end, I decided that, I only kind of needed two to bring that issue up, that, you know, that it's not stable, that the identity isn't stable. And I sometimes felt with the drawings that some of them were more like the person I was drawing, and some of them were better drawings. And I also didn't know how to resolve that, because, you know, is a portrait the best it can be when it's like the person, or is it the best it can be when it has some other kind of essence in it? So again, you know, it felt like if I positioned two next to each other, then I could have that kind of possibility, that instability of, you know, who the person is, and also what job does the drawing do. But there's definitely, you know, with the kind of procedural thing that you were talking about, you know, I did want it to be quite mechanistic, because obviously the subject matter is so emotive, you know, it's really, it's clearly to do with my own experience, but also, you know, so I had to find some way of tempering that, and that kind of more mechanistic way of making this drawing built up of, I had in my mind this idea. I remember years and years ago when I first went to art school, we did a day trip to Amsterdam, and there was like one of those photo booths. It was the first kind of computer booth where you go in and you get a printout, and it was all these kind of X's that made up your face. And I was just absolutely fascinated, you know, that you could build up this very personal image through, you know, this kind of repetitive mark. So I had that back in my mind that this is something I wanted to do. And I start in one corner. And with these large drawings, I'm literally squaring up the photograph and doing it bit by bit, and then wondering whether they're all going to come together as something else, going through this procedure.
I think it's amazing, because you capture that so beautifully, and you capture so clearly that these are different fleeting states of mind, which is, of course, what we're looking for. When somebody comes around the corner, we want to know what mood they're in, what they're feeling now. We don't want to necessarily know what personality they are. I thought that was done, that was done very, very subtly and very beautifully. And every single one of the pictures, I'm not sure what other people thought, but every single one of the pictures, I wanted to meet these girls. I thought they were really interesting, intriguing, and engaging for that reason. But it was you always capture this moment, this distinct moment, which I think is what psychoanalysis is trying to talk about and think about much more these days. We're not trying to capture the essence. We're not trying to make that interpretation that gets right to the heart. We're trying to capture moment by moment different states of mind.
Well, time is important, isn't it? I mean, both in the psychoanalytic encounter and in your kind of process, and moving between, you know, the photographs, the drawings, the copy. I mean, photography then, what I've written about a bit is in the essay, you know, the idea of copies. There's this, again, that can be what you were saying about identity and sort of fluctuation can be related to, I mean, you know, this idea that we don't have this idea, well, it still lurks in culture, I think, this idea of the original and its copy, and the copy was seen as like a second best, but now with kind of impact of digital technology, you know, there are only copies, there are only moments in a chain, rather than an original essence, which the copy then would be a kind of a second best thing. And that really is interesting as well in relation to, say, like a history of drawing in the art school as well, in the sense that, like when I went to my interview for art college with my portfolio, it was frowned upon and looked down on, because I had a portfolio full of what were considered to be copies of photographs. And why, what did I not do a still, you know, why couldn't I draw from still life? That there was this kind of, the idea of drawing from life was seen as an original, somehow a more privileged kind of act, that you could tap into this kind of reality. Whereas if you're copying, which I used to do lots of, copying from photographs, that was just seen as like lazy and a trivial activity.
But it's interesting in that memoir of the blind, when Derrida was talking about his brother who made mere copies from the family archive, which, you know, which he's trivialising but also kind of really wants to be able to do it. And he says, no, I do words, you know, he did images. And I think, still there's always that thing, you know, that it is second rate. And in a way, by making these copies and making myself feel more machine-like, don't think I ever achieved it, but sort of having that as an impetus, I think there's something that I'm trying to explore there about authenticity and, you know, what is more authentic. And, you know, it's a kind of that sort of meditative, you said you did them before you went to art school, it is a kind of teenage thing.
I would love to be doing them again, but I just got so put on by them.
I wonder how you felt about the series of portraits of something like Rembrandt, the whole series of portraits through his life, how that sort of impacts on much. How you feel about people, how you get to know people.
Yeah, I think Rembrandt's really interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I know it's corny, but when you look at a Rembrandt portrait, the whole thing that comes through it is this very genuine sort of sense of, well, yes, going back to the word authentic, that they feel that there's a huge amount of empathy for their sitter. You know, it's not a kind of very cool, hands-off rendition. Whether he's painting himself, whether he's painting his partner, there's a sense that he's really kind of getting to the heart of the person. And in a way, I suppose, I've never felt, you know, I couldn't ever even put myself in ballpark with that. So I kind of thought it a different route and looked about this kind of reproducibility of the image.
There's a resonance, though, with yours, because what we're talking about is a series in a lifetime with Rembrandt. And what I think what Saganassi is very good at is thinking about the difference between copies and resonances and echoes. And you know, Freud, of course, and Bolas wrote about the shadow of the object. And there are always these reverberations and resonances and shadows forming. And you see the ripples throughout. You see the ripples throughout Rembrandt's life in his portraits, and I think you see that in your lovely pictures as well. And I think, in a way, that little girl, you saw the shadows and resonances of reverberations from the gazes that she's had. She wasn't looking to, but she's had all these experiences. They're kind of reverberating through her, and I think that's what makes it so interesting, because there is only this moment, but that is a moment which requires these previous experiences, including the safe gazes.
I was thinking, though, what I thought you were saying as well was that, and it's interesting that the copying of photographs come up, is that in fact it's your perspective, it's your mood that's changed, isn't it? And that remains stable, and that's a different...
Yeah, because of course when I started this I thought it was all about children, and I realised it was all about me. there is that sense in which, you know, I felt that there was, particularly with the larger works, there was some sense in which I was empowering, you know, this kind of staring out. There was this sense of, again, I suppose because it's in the media a lot about, you know, the gaze that young girls receive and how they kind of deal with that and the damage that we do in that way. But then I realised, you know, that there was this whole other thing, you know, because I looked into an artist who works with children, a photographer, who works with children to come up with the image that they want of themselves. So they're kind of facilitating. But I realised, I didn't want to facilitate the children. You know, I knew what I wanted to get from the child. And I had to sort of, you know, orchestrate that into being. And whether... I think it's ambivalent, you know. I don't think it's either. I think there's a kind of ambivalence in play at play in the work, and in some way that they're portraits, they, you know, when I look at them, because I know the children that I've drawn, I can see things on their faces, and I read into their faces. You know, it's like, I don't know if you've done this, but if you look back at your family photographs when you're a kid, and you suddenly, you can see all this kind of drama that was, you, that was going on, but you didn't know it at the time. You just looked like a family photograph, and then you realise, oh, you know, so-and-so is really close to so-and-so, and, you know, all this whole kind of thing is being played out. So it's very, you know, it's very hard for me to get a distance on it, I think. And as has been said, you know, some, there are some drawings of my own children, and I find it very difficult to get a distance on that. You know, it's, I guess I'm doing them, and then I think I'll work out what they are in a few years' time, maybe.
I saw your show at the Museum of Childhood, and I thought it was a very interesting location, the drawings, because in a way the Museum of Childhood isn't about childhood at all, it's about the idea of childhood, or an adult's idea of childhood.
Well, someone said it was about consumerism, because actually what you do is you just see all the things that have been made for children,
to sort of project and define and frame the idea of childhood, but it's not really about childhood sort of per se, it's about the idea or the concept of childhood. And I was thinking about the way that you make the drawings and this very sort of meticulous process, but also the surface that you're working on. I don't really know much about the process, but the silver point goes onto gesso.
It does, yeah.
And I was thinking about this idea of interiority and trying to access this interior space and the essence and the impossibility of that.
Yeah.
And the whole tradition of portraiture where you're looking for the essence and trying to find the essence of this sort of being. And I thought it was a really interesting sort of material sort of way of kind of circumventing that, that you're kind of, that you're trying to enter a sort of inert surface, and yet it's like sort of plasterwork or paint, that it's, you know, that there's a resistance somehow.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm describing
well, I think it's interesting about the Museum of Childhood, because what's interesting about the Museum of Childhood is though it is just this kind of all this kind of stuff, and it is about, as you say, a kind of constructed idea, and that's what they're interested in exploring, people take their children there. And so it's just full of children running around. So I knew that. I knew I'd have an audience there of children, almost as a kind of byproduct, but I did think, you know, I suppose over the period of doing this, I did two shows there, curated a show there, and I did a, and I put my drawings there as well. And over that period of time of being familiar with the museum, I got to realise that, you know, maybe this wasn't going to be the thing that I thought it was. But I was interested in, you know, at the opening, a lot of the kids came who were in the pictures, and they kind of felt themselves in the museum, and I was quite interested in that aspect. I mean, in terms of the materiality, yeah, I think there's something about this sort of trying to sort of pull the image out of the material.
I mean, you could have worked in pencil and paper, which is when I first saw the drawings.
They were pencil and paper, but those ones. But these new ones are silver point, and I didn't know what silver point was. Someone, Lindsay, who's here, suggested that I use silver point because of the way that I was marking. I thought it was like etching. And then I realised that what I could get with silver point was a very fine line. And over the time, I quite liked that it had this kind of tradition, and people didn't know quite what it was.
And you can't remember sounds.
You can. I only discovered this very recently. You've got a cotton bud, you know.
Great things that help permanent.
But there is a sense, yeah. I mean,
pencil,
and some of the drawings,
kind of smudge,
once you make a mark, and it doesn't go away. And what I wanted to do was avoid. I said that I wanted them to be anti-expressionistic, which isn't really fair because there is always expression. In a line, but I was trying to move away from that because I felt the subject matter was so loaded, and also because I suppose I wanted it to relate to drawings that I loved that were historical drawings. So, you know, I wanted there to be that kind of lineage there, even if I didn't feel I could match it. I wanted to have that kind of sense, that, that sort of historical trajectory.
So I've got one more, if I may. Just wanted to ask you, is the techniques that you're using, would there be a sort of a diagnostic benefit in being able to sort out which children are actually autistic or Asperger's compared to those that have been traumatised? Is there something you can learn from what you're learning there?
From what I'm doing, what way?
From the sort of looking at the pictures like this, where you're appearing.
In a way, I think you're using the same. In a sense, I think that as a clinician, it's probably not that different to what the rest of us are doing most of the time, which is that we use ourselves and our beings and our bodies as sounding boards to make sense of, to make sense of the other. And often we find with children who are very much on the autistic Asperger's spectrum, you can do all kinds of diagnostic tests, but you can also feel in yourself what's going on or what isn't going on in their minds when you're with them, which really, well, that's the key. That's what gives us the information, I suppose. I'm not sure if that's helpful or not.
That's probably enough.
You can say something.
Oh, sorry, just so quick.
Go on, yeah, and somebody here.
I was just wondering, is the colouring of the paper a motive? Or why is the colouring?
I hate that question, because really? I just don't have an answer for it.
Oh, really?
So, yes, it is. The first lot, using my childhood that we saw, quick image of, I wanted to have a range of cool colours. And then when I came to do these, I just wanted to heat it up. And I honestly, we shouldn't say it in public, but the first one was the one in the middle there. And that girl has got this most amazing mane of red hair. And I think I just took the cue from her hair. And then I wanted to have this quite hot thing that was in contrast to the cooler ones. Sorry.
I guess I just wanted to say that the thing that I find most profound is the relationship between looking at an artwork and trying to find meaning and looking at a face and trying to find meaning. And a lot of what you were saying about there being a very fine line between, I won't be able to say again how you said it, and it's very evocative, but the as an art, I'm an art historian actually, and so I wonder if this is something perhaps you try and help me to put into words. But there's something about, I think, like looking at this work from almost a sort of feminist perspective, as opposed, for example, to something that struck me actually, and I'm sure that this was, it may or may not be intended, and I'd be interested to know. There's two sets of images, faces that were juxtaposed next to each other. Of children of different ethnic backgrounds, but that when they were put together you saw were quite similar visually. And so it made me think that you could come at your work from a completely different angle. And I wondered, as an artist, how it makes you feel, this experience of everybody looking at your work, and does that relate? I'm going kind of 360 around to the idea of a child opening its eyes or shutting its eyes to the world and being someone else investing in you, meaning.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as I was saying earlier, you know, I've got this three essays in the book that we're launching, and they all have really different perspectives. And I kind of, the exciting thing for me in making art is when someone tells you what you've done, but you didn't know you'd done it. And when that happens, that is, you know, very, very exciting, because it is almost this kind of recognition where you say, you know, I knew that was floating around in there, but I couldn't articulate it. That's why you get asked really good writers to write about your work, because you get to get that articulated for you. And then I think you use that as a stepping stone for the thing you do next. So, I mean, I teach art, so a lot of students who, you know, are required to articulate what they're doing, or, you know, as they're doing it almost, and they don't always know. And I kind of say, well, you know, that's fine. You do the thing that drives you, but at some point you're going to have to work out what it is you've done. And if you've got other people helping you, that's really great. And I do realise that well, I said before, you know, you start off doing one thing and then you realise actually, you know, you've done something else. And I can see echoed my work. Someone who's known my work over 20 years looked at it yesterday. She said, this looks really different. But to me, I'm still looking at the same things. They might have different visual forms, but the issues just keep on recurring. And you just hope that they kind of go beyond you and that somebody else can make sense of them. And when you do, that's like, you know, that's the best thing.
That sounds so much like the process of psychotherapy. Somebody has
done them.
Yeah. And having somebody to help you see what you're doing is changing.
Yeah, it's kind of
external.
Or having somebody like Christopher Bonus talks about that helps you become the self you couldn't quite become without even necessarily knowing about it. But yeah, pretty interesting.
No, that's all. I'd like to ask Rebecca, you mentioned that the subject matter is so loaded, and it seems a lot of discussion is about our reflection of our own gaze onto the portraits, rather than maybe you're talking more about the interiority of the subject. And we mentioned the exhibition at Bethnal,
Bethnal Green.
Exhibiting somewhere that is supposed to be about childhood or a view of childhood and the associations of the Freud Museum with Anna Freud, have these in some ways created a more permissive space for you to develop work? Did it impact on
your... absolutely. I mean, I don't feel like I've got any place to go on board. I feel like, you know, the work for me, it's not just about... I don't think it's just about a kind of, you know, personal voyage, but I feel like if it's got currency, if it means something, it might mean something to people who aren't used to looking at art rather than people who are. So, you know, that was a really deliberate move. I wanted to do the Museum of Childhood because I like the place and I like that, you know, that it had a wide range of people that went to it, a non-art going audience. But, you know, similarly here, I feel like I'm going to learn something different. But also because I don't know, you know, the work's not commercial. Sometimes I'll give the work to the parents of the people I've drawn it. You know, very rarely would I take on a commission because, you know, people don't, I have to say, you know, this is what I do and I'm not going to do your child smiling and, you know, the version that you might want. You might get something a little bit darker than that because people do have, you know, sometimes people do have quite a... it's not how they see their child, you know. It's almost like I suppose it's like that thing where you catch yourself in a reflection and that's not how you see you. When you come to the mirror, you know the face you're going to show yourself and you show yourself that face and you see that face. And I think that quite often happens with, you know, people that you're close to as well. It's quite surprising when you see your child configured in a different way. So you know, I don't think they fit kind of commercially, but I do want them to be seen where I get perhaps... there's a different kind of currency, I suppose. There's a different kind of relationship to the subject. So here was, you know, great for that. But we should probably go have a drink. So thank you all for coming.